Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 26. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Today's guest is Dr. Dennis McKenna. Today we discuss Ukuhe, ayahuasca, habit and novelty theory, Terence McKenna, plant communication, and the future of psychedelic research. For the last 30 years, Dennis McKenna has pursued the interdisciplinary study of ethnopharmacology and plant hallucinogens. He is the co-author with his brother Terence McKenna of The Invisible Landscape, Mind, Hallucinogens, and the I Ching. A philosophical and metaphysical exploration of the ontological implications of the psychedelic drugs which resulted from the two brothers' early investigations of Amazonian hallucinogens in 1971. He received his doctorate in 1984 from the University of British Columbia. His doctoral research focused on ethnopharmacological investigations of the botany, chemistry, and pharmacology of ayahuasca and ukuhe, two orally active tryptamine-based hallucinogens used by indigenous peoples in the northwest Amazon. Following the completion of his doctorate, Dr. Dennis McKenna received his postdoctoral research fellowship in the Laboratory of Clinical Pharmacology, National Institute of Mental Health, and the Department of Neurology, Stanford University School of Medicine. In 1990, he joined Shaman Pharmaceuticals as director of ethnopharmacology. He joined the Center for Spirituality and Healing at the University of Minnesota in 2001, and as Senior Lecturer and Research Associate. He is a founding board member and vice president of the Hefter Research Institute, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to the investigation of therapeutic applications for psychedelic plants and compounds. He was a primary organizer and key scientific collaborator for the Huasca Project, an international biomedical study of huasca, a psychoactive drink used in ritual contexts by indigenous peoples and syncretic religious groups in Brazil. He has conducted extensive ethnopharmacological fieldwork in the Peruvian, Colombian, and Brazilian Amazon. He has served as invited speaker at numerous scientific congresses, seminars, and symposia. Dr. McKenna is author or co-author of over 40 scientific papers and peer-reviewed journals. His publications have appeared in the Journal of Ethnopharmacology, European Journal of Pharmacology, Brain Research, Journal of Neuroscience, Journal of Neurochemistry, Journal of Nervous and Mental Disorders, Economic Botany, and elsewhere. Upcoming shows, Professor Marlene Dobkin de Rios, I plan to have on hopefully for next week, at least that's what's planned. Following that, on the 27th, will be Dr. Marguerite Rigoglioso, and she is the author of The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece, and hang on for that one, that's one you're not going to want to miss, and she's got some mind-blowing information in her new book, so I can't wait to have her on to discuss that. Also coming up will be Wolfgang Bauer, the German co-author of Der Fliegenpilz. And after Wolfgang Bauer, I hope to have Dr. Neil Goldsmith on, and we'll be discussing psychedelics and psycho-spiritual development. And as an update, I expect to have the Spanish subtitle version of the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD released tomorrow on the pharmacraticinquisition.com website. Also coming up in the next week or two will be the release of the Russian subtitle version of that. And I also hope to have a Polish version out and available of that soon, too. And if you're listening to this show and can help with German or French editions and possibly Arabic, I would love to add those shows to the DVD and online versions of the video. So if you can help with that, please contact me. And if any of you out there listening can help with audio transcriptions, we would appreciate that as well. We still have a few shows left that need to be transcribed, and I can use all the help on that I can get. It's a big project. I'd like to get all of the interviews transcribed, so if you can help with that, please also contact me for that. And it's a great way to help if you want to support this show and what we do here. And this show is run on donations, so if you would like to support this programming, you can also go to GnosticMedia.com, that's GNOSTICmedia.com, and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. This show is not corporate media, it is independent media in the truest sense of the words, and by supporting it, you help continue our programming. And without your help, we wouldn't be here, so we appreciate everyone who's been donating and supporting the show and what we do here by ordering a book or DVD from the website. That's also another way that you can help. Still have copies of the new version of Astrotheology and Shamanism available, and the DVD is also available. Also still available are the brand new color edition of the second edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, which was not available before. The color edition does come with a free Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD. And I also have copies available of my newest book, The Holy Mushroom, which is available on the website anyway. And if you would like to contact me, please feel free to contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And once again, the website, www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for my interview with Dr. Dennis McKenna. So how are you doing today?
Oh, pretty good, pretty good. There's a big snowstorm on the way, and so, you know, I'm bummed about that. I thought we might get a little spring here, but I guess not. You know, so I've just been working on my lecture for my next class, and reasonably productive day so far. How about you?
Mine has been reasonably productive, although I could get a lot more accomplished, but working on this book project and getting all of you guys into it, I think, will serve the field in the long term, hopefully, very well. So I've got a lot of big names like you in this, so I really appreciate you taking part in it, and you know, so anyway, you know what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying. Okay, so let's go.
All right. Well, let's start off. Why don't you tell me who Dennis J. McKenna is, or Dr. Dennis J. McKenna?
Okay, well, I'm still working on that. I guess you could say professionally, I guess I can cop to being an ethnopharmacologist. I've been studying, ethnopharmacology is the study of the relationship between, people and biologically active substances. And so that's a broad field, and I've been preoccupied with that for many years, both on, sort of on a personal level and professional level. So that's, I guess I can cop to saying I'm an ethnopharmacologist. So I became interested in this really because, you know, I was a child of the 60s and interested in psychedelics, and that's really what led me in this direction. But early on in my work with psychedelics, I sort of became aware of, you know, I was immersed in the cultural context of my time, but I became aware through the writings of Carlos Castaneda and others that there was a whole other context for the use of these plants and substances outside of our cultural context. And so I was very interested. I became interested in studying, their use in the context of cultures that possibly knew something about them, which our culture really didn't. So that's kind of how I was led into this. I've been working in various aspects of this field ever since.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in Colorado called Paonia, Colorado, on the western slope, not too far from Aspen. Both my brother and I grew up there. I spent the first 17 years of my life there. And, you know, it was a nice town. But at the time, of course, I didn't think so. I didn't have sense enough to realize that it was a pretty nice place, really. Just a typical small Colorado town. And that's where I grew up. And I went to the University of Colorado and Colorado State University for a while, and then I sort of began my graduate career. I went to the University of Hawaii and studied for a master's in botany, in botanical sciences, and then I ended up at the University of British Columbia studying under Dr. Neil Towers in the botany department, and he was really the mentor that got me started on my serious study of psychopharmacology, or I mean ethnopharmacology and psychopharmacology for that matter. With his encouragement, I changed my graduate direction, the direction of my studies, and ended up going to South America to investigate ayahuasca. That's been a kind of a focus of my research and professional interest ever since, really. I mean, I have to credit ayahuasca in some ways, and, you know, which encompasses a whole bunch of different interests. I have to credit it into really, it's been sort of a continuing carrot that's led me down my professional path, and also, you know, my own personal path of interest in these things, you know, shamanic states of mind and people's relationships with psychoactive plants and altered states of consciousness and all of that.
You have a doctor's degree too. Where did you get your doctor's degree?
Well, I'm not a real doctor. I'm a PhD. I'm not a medical doctor. Yeah. Well, I got my PhD at the University of British Columbia. I got a master's at the University of Hawaii and my PhD at UBC. And my thesis project was a kind of an interdisciplinary investigation of ayahuasca and, chemistry, botany, pharmacology, and social context. But it was also a comparison of ayahuasca, which is a orally active tryptamine hallucinogen that's, of course, as you know, very important in Amazonian shamanism. But it was a comparison of that with another South American hallucinogen, much less known, called ukue, a witoto preparation from varola, which is another, which is a species of trees in the nutmeg family. And varola also contains tryptamines. Usually it's used as a snuff, but some tribes, including the Witoto, use it as an orally active preparation, and that's essentially what my thesis was a comparison, kind of the chemistry and pharmacology of ayahuasca and varola, or ayahuasca and this specific preparation, which the Witoto called ukuhe.
And you worked for some interesting companies, and you've held some pretty interesting positions in those companies. Could you talk about your role in the development of natural products?
Well, yeah. After I finished my thesis work at UBC, I sort of became the world's longest unemployed postdoc. I did three different postdocs trying to pursue this interest in hallucinogens. One of them was at the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda, Maryland. I got a two-year fellowship there, and then I went to, after I finished that, I did another postdoc at Stanford in the neurology department. And all of that was directed at looking at serotonin receptors and actually trying to map out and characterize hallucinogen receptors. So in the brain, mostly in rats' brains, but you got to start somewhere. And so I was very lucky that I was able to pursue that work. And at the end of my postdoc at Stanford, there was a new company, startup pharmaceutical company, starting up in California called Shaman Pharmaceuticals. And they were going to, rediscover or discover all those unknown remedies in the rainforest that we keep hearing about. And so for me, it was a good chance to kind of take what I learned in my sort of detour out of ethnopharmacology into neuropharmacology. It was a chance to utilize that knowledge and reapply it to natural products, apply it to the investigation of some of these traditional medicines. So I joined them in 1990, I believe, and as director of ethnopharmacology, which was a fancy sounding title, but on the ground, it was basically, my job was to set up screening protocols for a variety of neural receptors. They had a small part of their resources were devoted to the discovery of new CNS active drugs. And as it turned out, I just came fresh with these skills from my postdoc, so I was a good match for what they needed. And so I worked for Shaman for about 2.5 years. And then I came out here to Minnesota to work for Aveda Corporation, which you know is a cosmetics company. And at the time, they offered me a better job in terms of salary, and they offered me a challenge, which is that they wanted to set up a program in ethnopharmacology and it seemed attractive, and so I came here and I worked for Aveda for another 2.5 years, mostly in the area of developing dietary supplements. Back at this time, the laws regulating the sale of dietary supplements, DSHEA, is what they're called, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, was passed in 1993, and suddenly, following that, the herbal products industry kind of took off. So it was a good opportunity to come to a company like Aveda and start to develop some products. But after a couple of years, I sort of decided that it wasn't really a good match for me. In some ways, it was disappointing. And I sort of slowly came to realize that I probably couldn't work for any corporation, at least not as an employee. And so I left Aveda and I ended up working as a consultant. Independent consultant is, I guess, another way of saying unemployed, but actually I wasn't unemployed because I had lots of consulting by that time. So I ended up working as an independent consultant for a variety of dietary supplement and herbal products companies throughout the 90s. And so that kept, you know, food on the table and gave me a certain independence, and that continued. And then in 1999, my brother came down with a brain tumor, and which was shocking to everyone, to us, to him especially. And so I basically, you know, I spent the next year being there for him. I more or less gave up my consulting work, and we spent the next year trying to figure out what we were going to do about this, what we could do about it. And of course, there's very little that that could be done about it. He had the most virulent form of brain cancer that you can have, and the usual diagnosis is you live about a year after you're diagnosed, you know, and it's 98% mortality. So we did everything we could to try and find a solution to that. He ended up taking an experimental gene therapy at University of California, San Francisco. We sorted through many options, and because I was the scientist of the family and had some background in pharmacology and biology and neuroscience and this and that, I sort of became the person that had to, you know, sort through the science and figure out if there were any good options for treatment. And we settled on this gene therapy, which was carried out, but it didn't work, obviously. He died in April of 2003. In fact, in a couple of days, it'll be the 9th anniversary of his death. He died on April
2000.
3rd. I'm sorry, 2000. Yeah, he died in April 2000.
So it's been almost exactly 9 years this week.
Almost exactly 9 years this week. Yeah, which is rather amazing when I think back on it. It certainly doesn't seem that long, but it was. And so at the end of that time, I when you're a consultant and you're not out there getting business, you know, your consulting business goes away. You have to keep getting it. So at the end of that time, after his death, I was pretty much bereft. I had no job and no real work. at least no chance to reconstruct my consulting business. So at the time, I had just completed a massive reference book on herbal supplements along with some colleagues. We've done it as a contract for a company, but then they relinquished the rights to it, and it was, you know, we were negotiating for a publisher.
You're talking about the book Botanical Medicines, the desk reference for major herbal supplements?
That's right. That's right. Eventually, the work we'd done for this company was revised and published as that book. And about a few months after Terrence had passed on, that work came to the attention of some people at the Center for Spirituality and Healing at the University of Minnesota, which is the alternative or complementary medicine program there. And as it happened, they were looking for someone to teach a course in ethnobotany and or in herbal medicines. And so they were impressed with the book, and it seemed like a good match. And so that was my first sort of penetration into academia, was when I went to work for them to teach a course that I developed called Ethnopharmacology, formerly called People, Plants, and Drugs, an Introduction to Ethnopharmacology. And that was the beginning. And then later I developed a course on botanical medicines, and I still teach both of those at the university, plus a couple more. So it was good. It was an opportunity to kind of find employment again, which was a good thing. But also I found that I really enjoyed the opportunity to teach. So I guess I was more suited to be an academic perhaps than a corporate researcher. So
I think we can all understand
there,
that.
Yeah, still plugging away.
Well, it sounds like you've got a pretty well-rounded background in science as well as obviously philosophy and things like that that many have heard you talk about. Mm-hmm. Many of us have heard your brother's wild stories about taking morning glories as a boy and doing things like that. And you talked about a little bit about your involvement as being a 60s child, but what was the trigger that led you to the path? Were you sipping morning glory tea with your brother, or how did that happen?
Well, no, not exactly like that, although he was certainly a very formative influence on my development. There's no doubt about that. He was the older brother. He was 4 years older than I was, than I am. And he went early on. He left Paonia early while he was still in high school and went out to California to live with my aunt and uncle to finish school. He hated Paonia even worse than I did and badgered my parents to leave, and eventually they did give in and let him go. So after he graduated from high school, he went to Berkeley, to the University of California at Berkeley, and that was right at the time when the free speech movement was, you know, just over. There was a lot of political and cultural ferment, and there was, you know, and the 60s were in full swing, and he got into it, with both feet, so he would come home on at Christmas and in the summer and so on, and we would hang out together, and it was really our shared interest in science fiction that really sort of in some ways was the theme of our common interests, at least when we were younger. You know, I mean, if we were both kind of nerdy, I guess, both kind of intellectual, or at least had pretensions to be that.
Right.
And right. You know, we were interested in odd things, and of course, drugs are some of the oddest things. So, in you know, in Terrence's experience at Berkeley, he quickly came in touch with all these different psychedelics, cannabis and different psychedelics, which is pretty much what was happening at that time. He came back one summer and you know, turned me on to cannabis for the first time, I think when I was 15. It was a very different kind of environment then. I mean, we simply, you know, went over to the city park. We lived across the street from the city park and sat down and, you know, he pulled out the pipe and, you know, we fired up. And that was my first introduction to any of these psychoactive drugs. And then in the summer of 67, I went out to California, and this was the summer of love and all that, the summer of, you know, the hippies were at their height. But I guess what really impressed us, or sort of, you know, where our interest kind of went in some unique directions was when we found out about DMT, and we got interested in DMT, which was very rare. Even in the 60s, it was almost never encountered. It was not a drug that was common, but it was around. And he got some, and we both thought it was kind of the, you know, the quintessential psychedelic in some ways. I mean, we were very impressed with how strange it was, how overwhelming it was, and we were fascinated by that. And even more so when we found that it was, you know, found in many plants, and that it was really the basis of a lot of shamanic plant-based practices in South America. And so that was really the hook that led us to eventually go to South America. It was trying to find a better form of DMT.
I wanted to ask you if you were familiar with Rick Simpson's work using cannabis to treat cancer. He's done some very fascinating research. He's out of Saskatchewan, Canada, and I had him on the show a couple of months back, but I was wondering if you had heard of his research and his treatment methods.
Sure. Yeah, I am not familiar with Rick Simpson's work on cancer and using cannabis to treat cancer. I have followed a little bit some of the research in this area. There's some evidence apparently that cancer may in fact inhibit the growth of brain tumors. And in fact, that came to light when Terrence was still sick. And as Terrence used to say, well, you know, if cannabis cured brain tumors, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But, well, it didn't work for him. Let's put it that way.
They don't use it by smoking it, but what they do is they create a tar, basically the essential oils of very strong indica buds. And,
oh, yeah.
And then you consume this essential oil. And what he does is basically you're consuming a pound of this stuff over a 2 to 3 month period in this high concentrated extract form. And he, as well as a couple of other people who have administered it and have also done it, have reported back to me that they've had significant results. So what I'll do is, you know, after the show, I'll send you an email with his information and exactly how he's going about it, because I would love to, get your feedback from a scientific perspective on what he's doing there.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more about it.
So many of us have read Terrence's account of your experience in his book, True Hallucinations. Would you care to discuss your experience there and this blue or green ooze that he discussed in that book?
Well, yes and no. I have discussed it many places, and you know, and every time I sort of approach it with hesitation, because for one thing, it makes it sound like, you know, I'm a complete nutcase, and you know, for another, it's very hard to explain it succinctly.
Well, that's a great caveat to start off with.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, you know, those people who are familiar with True Hallucinations, you know the story, but I guess, briefly, you know, one of the, I mean, what originally motivated us to go to South America in 1971 was this effort to find this drug, Ukuhe, this Metoto drug, which we had read about in the Harvard Botanical Museum leaflets. And, you know, we thought that this might be this orally active form of DMT, because DMT is not normally orally active. You have to, the synthetic compound, you have to smoke it in a pipe, and it produces a very rapid, very overwhelming, but very rapid psychedelic experience. And, you know, and that had been our experience of it. But the problem with that is it's difficult to retrieve much from it. It happens, it's overwhelming, and it's all over in 10 minutes. So we were interested in maybe in this orally active form, because we thought it would be a chance to spend more time in that place and actually kind of get a better handle on just what the hell was going on when in the so-called DMT dimension. So that was our motivation for going to South America. And, was to find an orally active form of DMT. And we were led to go to La Chirera, because that was the ancestral home of the Witoto. That's how we ended up there. And, when we got there, well, you know, the story is told in True Hallucinations, but basically when we got there, we became distracted in some ways by the fact that the psilocybin mushrooms, Psilocybe cubensis, were literally everywhere in this little village that we'd come to. It was a Capuchin mission settlement, and the forest around the settlement had been cleared, and there were pastures, and they had put in Cebu cattle. Well, Psilocybe cubensis likes to grow on the dung of Cebu cattle more than any other substrate. So they were around all over the place. And we, you know, we knew what they were. We had enough ethnobotanical savvy to sort of know what they were, but we didn't really take them seriously. You know, we started eating them more or less as a recreational, you know, activity, and we, you know, we thought that Ukuhe must surely be the real mystery, but we couldn't, you know, we were inhibited from just going in and asking around. We had to wait for it to come to us. And eventually we did find it. It proved to be quite disappointing. But by that time we were already, you know, well into the mushrooms. And, you know, and you know, one of the phenomena that Terrence experienced when smoking DMT, which he describes in True Hallucinations, was this experience of, you know, in a hyper DMT state, some kind of a substance or a what he calls the violet psychofluid or something appears to come out of his body. And, you know, I mean, this is not a reliable function of DMT. I don't think everybody has that effect, but it happened to him and he describes it, and it wasn't clear what it was. But as we looked into the anthropological literature, we found something very analogous to that, that the Hivaro shamans, or they're now called, properly called the Shuar, take ayahuasca on a, you know, almost constant basis, or they use it a great deal. It's the basis of all of their magic and all of their moho, in a sense, is ayahuasca. And one of the modalities that comes up in Shuar shamanism is the shaman will cough up or produce out of his body a substance that has magical properties, seems transdimensional in some way, something that they can spread out in front of them on the ground and actually look into and use for divination. Not unlike they can see the future, they can use it to diagnose illness, they can, you know, do all that stuff. And not unlike the, you know, it's analogous really to the way that the alchemists talked about a scrying stone or an alchemical mirror, something not unlike a crystal ball, I suppose, except that, you know, this was a fluid thing, and you know, it had these properties. So that is really the basis of this psychofluid, or this magical substance, which we ended up calling translinguistic matter. And, you know, for lack of a better name, you know, we thought that it was, you know, I mean, something that you could actually produce out of your body under the state of tryptamine intoxication. And one of our preoccupations became how to actually exteriorize this material and fix this material in some way so that, you know, it wasn't, you know, so that somebody else could see it. I mean, you know, and that was really the whole basis of the experiment at La Chirera, you know. But the... Well, it's difficult to describe it because in the act of describing it, you know, you have to, you know, I mean, it just sounds absolutely crazy, and I'm not, you know, I mean, it's not clear whether we were deluded or whether we were really on to something. You know, I mean, so we devised this idea about how you could fix this material and you could produce it and actually nail it down in some ways, you know, much like the alchemists talk about the notion that you have to, you know, in order to build the philosopher's stone, you have to, you know, you have to fix it. You have to fix the mercury. They conceive of a similar substance to what we thought as mercury. And mercury, of course, is a fluid. It's mercurial by definition. Part of what the alchemical process is all about is the effort to fix the mercury in a form that can be, you know, held in the hand and manipulated. And This is really what we were trying to do at La Chirera.
Looking back on that now, what do you think of that substance that you were working with then? Do you still think there's something worthy of investigation, or have you moved beyond it today?
Well, I don't know if I'd move beyond it. I mean, if such a thing could be invented, it would be a fantastic thing. I mean, it would be, in fact, as we said it would be at that time, it would be the ultimate artifact, because it would be an artifact that combined the properties of mind and the properties of matter in conjunction with each other. So it would be an amazing thing, but I think it's very hard to sort out. I think that we were majorly deluded in some ways, by taking the mushrooms. You know, it was suggesting these ideas, and we were trying to devise an experiment. But I wouldn't really call it an experiment. It was more like a ritual than anything else. Having said that, if you look, we're not the first ones to conceive of such a notion. The alchemists were on this, have been on it for hundreds of years, this idea that you can create some kind of an artifact that has the properties of both mind and matter. That idea, it has been around for a long time, or in contemporary context, the notion of the UFO, which is, again, I think just a metaphor for this ultimate artifact, this thing that can essentially do anything because it is made of imagination. So it can respond to your imagination. It can do whatever you tell it to, whatever you can dream up for it to do. If I wasn't a little skeptical about it at this point in my life, I should probably get some psychiatric help. I don't know. It's a fascinating idea. There are aspects of it that are, still very appealing. I mean, some of what we postulated was going to happen has, since found some validation in biophysics and this sort of thing. But in general, it's still a pretty wild notion. And, what we postulated was going to happen when we tried to create this thing obviously didn't. And in fact, couldn't, because it violated all kinds of physical laws. But other things did happen. And, not the least of all, what happened was our kind of simultaneous psychosis, you could say. You could characterize it as that, or you could be more kind and characterize it as a more like a shamanic election. I think we got ourselves into a place where we were absolutely convinced that something was going to happen, and something, earth-shattering or history-shattering was going to happen. And so when we performed this experiment, what we predicted would happen didn't happen, but other things did happen. And not on a global basis, obviously, but very much between us, between my brother and myself, and we went on this shared psychonautic odyssey, I guess you could say, that lasted about 14 days, and that was kind of the, triggered by our attempt to shatter space and time and bring history to an end. not that we weren't ambitious or anything,
Right.
I mean, that was the agenda.
I noticed you still wear glasses. I think you had thrown your glasses off and said you wouldn't need them anymore at that point or something.
Yeah, well, that was my first mistake. Yes, I do wear glasses. Yeah. It did not transform me into a Superman, which was one of the things we postulated, just not even the goal of the thing, but just sort of a side effect of the whole thing was that, you know, we would have superconducting DNA and we would be, you know, essentially these immortal beings.
What you basically, it sounds like what you had happen, which is typical in many people's experiences and has been documented clinically, like by Stan Grof, was sounds like you had a pretty major telepathic experience between yourself and Terrence.
We did, yes. We did have a strong telepathic experience. Even beyond that a little bit, we had, you know, what appeared to be access to some kind of, I don't know what you would call it, some sort of Akashic record, some sort of cosmic database, in a sense, where all knowledge, and knowledge that would not particularly be available to us, seemed to be available. And, you know, we could query, you know, it, the thing, whatever it was, this thing that we, this tiger that we had by the tail, we could ask it questions, and it would come back with answers. The problem, you know, you could, in the Amazon, you could pick up a plant and say, you know, what is the name of this plant? And, you know, it would immediately come back. The problem is, we have no idea if we, you know, any of this was true or not. You know, no way right. really to verify that.
Well, you know, I've had a very similar experience or two, what I call the pool of knowledge or something like that, where I could basically just... And in this vision I had, I had a metal camping cup with me, and I took this metal camping cup off my belt, and I started just drinking from this pool of knowledge in this trip, and all of these ideas and everything started pouring into me. But one thing I've found over the years that strikes me especially interesting, though, is the telepathy experiences, because many of them that I've had, I've been able to directly verify. I mean, about 5 years ago, I was on an ayahuasca experience with a friend of mine, and we were at his place, and he was in a separate room with the door closed, and we had total telepathy. And then he came out of the room, and we verified the entire conversation that we had just had via telepathy. So, and that's not, you know, the only time. I mean, you know, there's been dozens of similar type experiences that I can think about over the years. But I certainly understand where you're coming from on that, I think.
Right. I mean, these things do go on, you know, and I think that some of the telepathic experiences that we have then, and some I've had like yourself, similar to some that you've had, you know, I mean, they seem to be valid, you know, and I think that, well, it's just very tricky to get a handle on this. I mean, you can go into this with a complete, you know, sort of stance of reductionism and skepticism, you know, and you can think, well, it's all in your head, and all you're experiencing is, you know, it's all about your brain physiology, and it has nothing to do with the real world, or there's nothing paranormal here. But I think by taking such a narrow view of it, you risk missing something important. And at the same time, if you take a completely uncritical view, then, you know, you sort of give up that faculty and you just accept whatever, and that gives you no real basis for understanding. So I think it is this dynamic, and the being willing to sort of acknowledge that we don't know very much. We really don't know that much about our consciousness, our brains, experience. What are the limits, you know, of human experience? And, you know, I mean, with all we know about neuroscience and all of these fancy tools that we have for studying the brain, and, you know, all of these developments that have taken place in the last 30 years, nobody can still say what consciousness is. And yet, you know, I mean, we know it exists because we all experience it as part of our everyday life. But who can nail it down and say, well, consciousness, you know, is this? Who can give it some reductive explanation? It's just one of those aspects of reality that we have to admit we're still in the dark about, you know, and we may be in the dark about it for quite a long time.
What is this idea of hypercarbolation that you had during this experience? I know you mentioned just a few minutes ago this idea of interlocking or coming together with DNA. Could you talk about your concept there and what you think of that today?
Well, yeah, I mean, the hypercarbolation was a term that we coined to describe this experiment that we were trying to do. And we had this idea that, you know, on high doses of DMT and also on high doses of mushrooms, but more commonly with DMT, you can hear a sound if you're in a completely quiet place. And if you listen very carefully, you can hear a sound inside your head, which some people have described as a buzzing sound, or other people have said it's like crackling cellophane or whatever. But what we found, and this is what happened with Terrence when he first produced this violet fluid out of his body back in Kathmandu before any of this had happened, he found that by listening to the sound and imitating the sound, you could sort of lock on to it, and you could start, you know, with your voice, you could start singing and imitating the sound. Eventually, the sound would take over, and it would just pour out of you. And we found that on high doses of mushrooms, this was a pretty repeatable phenomenon. So we didn't really know. We hypothesized that what this sound was the electron spin resonance of the molecules in our neurons. Now, you know, this was, I mean, we're not biophysicists. I'm not a biophysicist now, but I know enough about biophysics to know that this was a completely, you know, incorrect notion. But we didn't know that at the time. So, you know, we were not inhibited, but we thought, well, if we could imitate this sound in a certain way that we could actually cause the, we could excite the harmine in our bodies and to intercalate into DNA in such a way that it would produce a standing waveform, a superconducting, essentially a hologram of DNA that would reflect the information that was in DNA. And, you know, that was what we were trying to do. That would be the artifact, that it would become visible. It would be something that would, you know, you would both see it and be it at the same time. And it would respond to the vibrations of thought, and it would be able to manifest, you know, any information. Now, you know, this idea that we had is so, you know, I mean, it's full of holes in so many different ways that I can't begin to tell you, you know, what a whack notion this was. But, you know, I mean, looking back of it from relative sanity and 30, almost 40 years later, looking back on it, I have to think, boy, these guys were, you know, completely nuts. And maybe so. But, you know, I mean, I'm certainly willing to admit that we were in a seriously altered state of reality, and we were divorced from ordinary reality. But in our state of mind, these ideas seem to make perfect sense, and they seem to make, you know, not only perfect sense, but they seem to, you know, the mushroom or whatever it was, this entity that we felt we were in touch with was, you know, kind of downloading the blueprints to us in what seemed like, you know, a very clear way, it more or less downloading the instructions. Here's how you do this thing. Here's how you build this translinguistic matter, or, you know, the philosopher's stone, or whatever you wanted to call it. And so in some ways we were just, it was like channeling. It was like automatic writing or something. We were just, all this information was being downloaded, and we seemed to know what to do. And so we went ahead and did it. And, you know, and it didn't work. It didn't work in the way that we said it was going to work, but it worked in certain other ways. I mean, I guess one thing that came out of this was my brother's, you know, invention of the time wave, based on the I Ching. I mean, that is something that came out of all this, that, you know, clearly, a result of our attempts. And, you know, it's a mathematical system, based on the I Ching, which he postulated was something that describes the structure of time. And again, I don't buy it now, but I do think it's a very interesting thing just on its own merits, you know, that he was able to construct this thing. So that is something that came out of it. I don't know. One of the long-term effects for me, you know, from this was the understanding essentially of how little I knew. And, you know, after the experiment, my brother, you know, was ready to essentially abandon science and say, well, science cannot explain any of this. But I was not so quick to do that because I, you know, my feeling was, well, we're not scientists. We don't understand science. We need to, or at least I needed to study science before I was ready to dispense with science. And so in some ways, that experience really sort of changed my own direction in terms of my own learning and all that. So, you know, I felt like in order to, you know, if you're going to be a critic of science, you have to understand science.
That's a good point.
How it works, you know. So we that sort of triggered a lot of reading on both our parts into things like Alfred North Whitehead, you know, general systems theory, you know, kind of the whole philosophical scientific tradition that has to do with, you know, the study of consciousness and biological systems and, you know, sort of these self-organizing systems, which, if you think about it, are still pretty unlikely. I mean, consciousness, nobody knows what that is, but we know it exists because we, presumably each of us has one most of the time, you know, and life itself, you know, is a pretty unlikely proposition when you think about it, you know, and we don't really understand what that is, and yet we're surrounded by it. We are living things, and is it, you know, is it something that just happens given the right conditions, or is there something more to it? You know, I mean, these are big questions.
Right.
And questions that I don't pretend to have the answer to, you know. I mean, if psychedelics have taught me anything, and my whole life experience really has taught me anything, it's that you know, I don't know much, and I dare say nobody knows much, you know. I mean, we're, as a species, especially scientists, I think are particularly sort of prone to arrogance, you know, to the notion that they really know a lot. And actually, I think they really don't know much. You know, science is a very good tool for understanding and examining in minute detail tiny slices of reality. You know, you can understand the structure of a cell or, you know, some process in great detail, where science isn't good. So far, it falls down when it comes to trying to, you know, fit all this together into a comprehensive map of the world and the way the world really is. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we have anything like a, you know, comprehensive scientific understanding of, you know, of the way it is, you know, or what my grandfather used to call, used to say, how the boar ate the cabbage. You know, we don't know how the boar ate the cabbage. And, you know, I think it's part of the human conundrum is that, you know, we, as human beings, we long for an answer. You know, we long for things to make sense. We long for there to be meaning. And science alone doesn't give us that. And so people tend to turn to spiritual practices or religions or whatever. And maybe on some level they derive some satisfaction from that. But it also seems to me that, you know, most religions don't have any answers either. I mean, I haven't found one yet that really, has them. But they're more than willing to tell you they do have the answers.
Right.
And I think that's very dangerous, you know. And science is the same way. I mean, the scientists are, you know, priests of their own type of religion, and they're ready to tell you they have the answers too. And, you know, as I've gotten older and more curmudgeonly, I've sort of decided that, you know, anybody tells you they've got the answers, they're full of shit, basically. Because I don't think anybody's got the answer.
Well, one thing you learn doing research over your life is the more research you do, the more you realize you don't know much. And,
exactly.
You know, and it's like that's the never-ending battle. But you talked about time wave zero and the habit novelty theory there briefly. You said today you didn't buy it. Could you discuss that? What led you to discount your own theory?
Well, it's not really. It was never really my theory. It was my brother's theory, and you know, he developed this, and I was always pretty skeptical about the whole idea. I think that in some ways, it's a very interesting thing. I think that he, you know, whether on purpose or by accident, I think that he probably rediscovered an ancient Chinese calendar. I buy it that far, you know, in that it can be used as a perfect 13-month lunar calendar. It can be used to predict astronomical events and all this type of thing. Just a minute here. My wife just got home.
Sure. You know.
Hello?
Yeah, do you hear me?
Can you hear me? Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I just wanted to let her know I was doing an interview down here. She's like, oh, no, not another one.
That's like my wife, too. You know, it's like I do almost as many interviews as I give almost as many interviews as I take. You know what I mean? So.
Right.
You know, December and January for us, I had an interview pretty much every other day there for, you know, it was getting pretty ridiculous. In fact, I've had two this week. What can you say, in your opinion, is the legacy of, or what can you say of Terence's legacy today? And in your opinion, what was his most important contribution?
Oh boy. Well, you know, the thing is, I mean, to go back to the time wave for a minute, I think that, you know, it was a very interesting mathematical construct. I think that, you know, where he overstepped the bound in some ways was in his postulation, his notion that somehow the wave described the structure of space, of time, rather, and, you know, had this predictive quality, and describe, you know, what he called the ingression of novelty into the continuum, and it didn't really provide evidence for that. And there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of reasons to think that it doesn't. I mean, there's no real evidence for it. You know, the problem with the time wave, as far as I see it, was that, you know, if it was being put forth as a theory, you know, theories have to be disprovable. You know, this is one thing that my scientific training has taught me. You know, if you're going to postulate a hypothesis, you have to define what will invalidate it. Or, you know, all scientific models are provisional, and you have to, you know, test them against reality, and either they stand up or they have to be revised or they have to be thrown out completely. Terence never really did that with the time wave theory. You know, he never was able to define the criteria that would invalidate it, you know, and so it became, you know, not useful. You know, really, he was the only person that could actually interpret it. You know, so in some ways, I think that he was forced to be, in some ways, intellectually dishonest with himself and with, you know, the people in his fans, if you will, or other people that were interested in this theory, because, you know, he was unable to really objectify it or provide any criteria that would, you know, determine what would disprove it. It's hard to say what Terence's legacy was. You know, I think in some ways, I mean, I think, you know, having dumped all this criticism on the time wave, I now turn around and say, in some sense, he was right in, I think that his notion that we are accelerating towards some kind of historical singularity, you know, was probably right on. I mean, you don't need the time wave to tell you that things are getting stranger and stranger and seem to be going faster and faster. And just the rate of change that is affecting our, you know, it seems apparent that things are, you know, headed somewhere, you know, towards some sort of critical event. But whether that's going to be, I mean, I do not believe it's going to be a single event, you know, on 2012, you know, December 21st, 2012. I do not believe that novelty really ingresses into the continuum that way, you know. But I do believe, and I think if you look back at the last decades, I do think novelty is a real thing, and it does ingress into reality. And I think maybe Terence's chief legacy was to sort of make people aware of that, you know, and even though that, yes, things are changing, things are stranger, you know, not only than you think they are, they're stranger than you can possibly imagine. And, right. You know, he's not the only one.
To quote John Haldane, I think, wasn't that John Haldane that said that originally?
JBS out. Right, exactly. That was what he said. You know, Terrence, you know, I mean, he was a complex guy, and he was, I mean, I think his legacy is that he led people to think about things that they would never otherwise think about. You know, it never would have occurred to them, all these crazy, wacky notions. And he was such a, he was a bard in some ways. He was so articulate, and people enjoyed listening to him. And he could say the craziest things in such a way that it seemed to make sense, you know, and people were accepting of it, and without too much critical thought. In fact, he used to hate for me to come to his seminars, you know, because I would challenge him, and, you know, I would say, well, you know, what you said didn't make any sense. You know, and it contradicts what you said 20 minutes ago, and that didn't make any sense either. So, you know, where's the sense in this? But he didn't, but it was okay because he said it so well, you know, and I really think that was it. I mean, he could have said just about anything, and, you know, having grown up with him, you know, I know that, I mean, one of the things that he always like doing is making provocative statements. And in some ways, I mean, he was kind of like, you know, I mean, he enjoyed shocking people with these radical statements. But in a way, it was like a wake-up call for many people. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, I never really thought about that before. So I really think that was his you know, that was his legacy in some ways, that he created a context where people really wondered, you know, about who are we? What is our place in the universe? You know, we're surrounded by mystery. We don't really know very much. And yet, you know, here we are in our existential situation. You know, we're living organisms on a planet that, you know, we appear to have intelligence. We appear to, you know, be part of this system. And how common is that? How, you know, is that something that's totally unique, or is that something that's just kind of ho-hum run of the mill? You know, we don't really know. So I think that was in some ways, you know, his real legacy was to just, make people think, you know. I remember when he was just beginning to sort of talk publicly, and wasn't really well known, but he would go to a few seminars and occasionally he'd be on the radio and so on. And one of his fans said, you know, I just love hearing you talk because you know, at the time, you remember, I don't know if you remember back in the 80s, do you remember Sing Along with Mitch?
I don't think Hello? I do. Yeah, I don't think I remember that. Do you hear
well,
me?
Well, he was a guy on television. He was, you know, and he had like a folk song type show, and he had a guitar and he'd come on and everybody would sing along with Mitch. And one of Terrence's fans said, you know, you're just like Sing Along with Mitch, except it's Think Along with Terrence. I thought that got it pretty well. You know?
Yeah.
He made people think. He stretched people's imagination. And I think that's his real legacy. And that's always a good thing, you know, just to exercise your imagination. Because of this thing, as we were just discussing, the world is almost certainly stranger than you could possibly imagine. So, you know, we're free to speculate, and speculation is fun.
Right.
And maybe even useful.
Maybe. What do you feel about the 2012 movement that's risen up today in large part because of Invisible Landscape?
Well, again, I am actually a skeptic about the 2012 movement for all the reasons that I just said in my criticism of the time wave. I'm sort of unsympathetic to it because I think that, you know, I mean, I think, as I say, in some broader context, we're right. You know, Terrence was right. We are headed towards some sort of, you know, singularity, some sort of radical change in the way we live on the earth. But I think in some ways it's irresponsible to tie all your hopes and all your expectations to one year or one particular event, you know. I mean, if you look at the history of prophecies, you know, if you look back, one thing you can say about the history of prophecies is they have always failed. There hasn't been a single one
always
that's ever come true, right? I mean, I can't think of one.
Y2K is a perfect example of that. And, well, you know, to me, it almost seems like...
Y2K is a perfect example.
Well, to me, it's always seemed like the whole 2012 thing is sort of a neo-pagan repackaging of the Christian apocalyptic theme.
Well, I completely agree. Yeah. I mean, it's exactly, that's what it is. And again, people... You know, I mean, it is exactly that, you know, the expectation that Jesus is going to come and save us, or, you know, the alien space brothers are going to show up in their mile wide ships and save us, you know, and what I tell people is forget it. You know, this is an excuse for not taking responsibility for yourself. You know,
exactly.
Jesus
yeah.
ain't coming. I'm sorry, you know, the aliens ain't coming. I'm sorry. It ain't going to happen, you know. We're in a pile of shit here. And it's, you know, it's up to us to get out of it. It's up to us to take responsibility. So in some ways, I mean, this has sort of become my latest rant. I'm sort of saying, you know, don't expect anyone to come along. You know, as a species and as individuals, you know, we're more than ready to give up responsibility. You know, we want wisdom dispensed from a guru or a priest, you know.
Yeah.
We want salvation to come from outside. You know, we want some cosmic force, you know, to intervene in history and save us from ourselves. I think that the whole 2012 meme is unhealthy in a sense, because again, it provides an incentive for people to not take responsibility and to sort of, you know, hope that, you know, well, after 2012, it'll all be good. And, you know, but no, I mean, there's no reason to think that, you know,
are you?
And so, you know, I mean, the thing is, and it encourages us to, you know, put it off, and
right.
We may not have till 2012. You
to
know,
put, yeah,
things
exactly.
are going to have a handbasket, and we need to get on it, you know, and not wait around for some postulated salvation.
Well, were you familiar with the fact that I did a couple of podcasts with Professor John Hupps from Kansas University and John Major Jenkins? Regarding debunking the whole 2012 thing, and we called it just that, the 2012 mem.
Yeah, no, I wasn't. But, well, John Major Jenkins, I'm not familiar with Professor Hutt's work. Is he a Mayanist? Or?
Yeah, he is. He's an anthropologist. He's director of the Global, I think it's Global Indigenous Studies Program out of Kansas University. But, yeah, he's a anthropologist, Maya scholar, graduated from Harvard, and I've been in touch with him for a number of years. We've had many, many great conversations, and I, you know, I, He has always separated Jenkins' work out from the rest of the 2012 group, and he wants Jenkins to submit his research for peer review. And so the interview was twofold. It was John Hupps coming on to attack the 2012 movement, dissect it, show where it originated and the original books that it came out of, like Michael Coe and Jose Arguelles and Terence McKenna's work, and that there was no citations beyond Michael Coe to any actual archaeological evidence. And then John Major Jenkins came on to defend a couple of points that Hoops attacked his work on, defended them very well, mm-hmm. in my opinion. And then just he also has, you know, really despises the 2012 movement, but he's found himself caught up in it to his own angst, you know. So
I'm more familiar with, I'm a little more familiar with John Major Jenkins, and I'm in agreement with this other professor. I respect his work more because, you know, it's more focused on the astronomical side of it. And there's no doubt, you know, that that's real. I mean, there are some very interesting astronomical alignments, this conjunction of, you know, the solstice point with the galactic equator and the ecliptic and all this. I mean, it's all, that's pretty much, built into celestial mechanics. So, you know, these conjunctions will take place, no doubt about it. But does it have a significance as far as events on Earth? I just don't think so. I mean, maybe on a symbolic level, but it's sort of like the harmonic convergence.
Well, I would argue it's more like, I would argue that it's more like December 21st or December 31st and January 1st. You know, it's symbolic. Yeah, okay, it's the new year. Yay, whoopee, and that's about the extent of it.
That's about it. Yeah. So I'm kind of with them on that. I mean, yes, it is the end of the Mayan calendar. And what does that mean? Well, you know, a lot of Mayanists will tell you that, well, the whole thing resets at that point and life goes on. You know?
Exactly.
what I tell people is, you know, we can all hope for something to come in 2012 or whatever and save us from ourselves, but I wouldn't count on it. And I haven't canceled my appointments for 2013. And, I don't think anybody should. I mean, I think, and I would love nothing more. I mean, I would love to have to eat a huge plate of crow over this, you know.
Me too.
December.
But in the meantime, all of those people that think it's the end of the world, they can just give me the keys to their house and their nice cars and everything else. And,
Right. And so often, I mean, that's the thing with all these millenarian and apocalyptarian movements. This is what, you know, this is what you see. You see the leaders of these things, you know, have a vested interest in having a flock that believes in this. And, you know, it's waste of time. It's another excuse for not taking responsibility for yourself.
I totally agree with you. And, the whole 2012 movement, and they're charging $350 a ticket and all of these sort of things. I'm sure you've heard some of the stories, but, it's all just, to me, you know, for those who are the serious anthropologists and the people that are serious about ethnopharmacology and everything, that sort of stuff really, I think, gives the whole rest of this field a black eye or a bad name.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Yeah. Are you talking about the upcoming event in Boulder Creek or Boulder Mountain in Utah,
or even
that one,
or even the one that was in L.A. last February, or the one that was in San Francisco a 6 months ago, 4 months ago, whenever it was, all of the above,
right.
I suppose.
Right.
Let me ask.
I didn't go to either of those two, but I am going to the one at Boulder Mountain. And, you know, I was invited to go, and it's a paid gig, so okay. You know, I'm there. I don't know what they expect me to say, but
Right. Basically
what I'm going to say is pretty much what I've said to you here. So I may be, there may be a few rotten tomatoes thrown. I don't know.
It may be your last
It may be my last appearance. Right. But really, I think this is the thing, you know, we have to be talking about reason and, you know, taking responsibility, thinking critically for ourselves, not accepting all this crap, you know, and the New Age community is as guilty of that as the most fundamentalists, you know. I mean, and it's the same dynamic. It's that somebody wants somebody else to tell them what to think.
Yeah,
you know,
well, they need their big mommy and daddy government God figure. You know, they need George Bush or Obama to hold their hand. And we're quickly finding out that Obama has reneged on what all of his campaign promises already. Last week they said no more raids on California medical marijuana clubs. And on the 25th, they started raiding them again, not even a week later. So, you know, it's just the same old, and until, like you said, until people start standing up and taking responsibility for themselves and taking action themselves, you know, it's going to continue like this.
Yeah, it's going to continue, and so that needs to be the message, I think. I mean, for, you know, and the thing is, there's always somebody who's willing to step in to the breach and say, yes, you know, I have the answers, I'm enlightened, or whatever, follow me. And so, you know, there are the credulous masses that are just looking for somebody to follow, somebody to you know, give them answers, and always someone who is more than willing to say, yeah, I'm the one. I have the way, the truth, and the light. And, you know, this has been the dynamic throughout history, and I think we've got to get away from that, you know, or we're totally lost. I mean, it's kind of like religion, you know. I mean, fundamentalism is, I call it sometimes, you know, simple answers for simple people, you know, and the answers are not simple. You know, and people are not simple, and they shouldn't assume that they are. You know, I mean, there may not be any one answer. I mean, I kind of answer to what, you know,
this like is string just, theory.
Yeah, this is just the ontological situation that we find ourselves in. You know, so I don't know.
I've got to say,
at the end of the day, I don't know. I mean, this
right.
is where the interview, you know, can end here in a sense, because I like, you know, at the end of the day, I think nobody knows very much about what is going on. And,
it's funny that you said that, because what I was just going to suggest is that we change gears in the course of this interview and get into, some of your other areas of research, because, you know, what I'd like to bring up is, you know, as I mentioned to you before, is where can we go in this? So I'd like you to, if you wouldn't mind, talk about your work with the Hefter Research Institute and, you know,
sure.
what type of plant medicines you've helped develop. And, you know, I'm especially interested in your thoughts on the state of modern pharmacology. So, you know, if you wouldn't mind starting to head that direction, let's do that.
Sure. Well, I mean, the Hefter Institute is it's a nonprofit organization Basically, we founded it in 1993, and it's basically an organization of people in various disciplines, ranging from psychiatrists to chemists to neuroscientists to myself. And I guess I represent the ethnopharmacology there, but we all have a common interest in fostering scientific research using psychedelics. I mean, that's the basic mission, you know, and our mission statement says, well, to relieve human suffering, which sounds good, but our preoccupation is psychedelics, and we basically think that psychedelics are, you know, have great potential both for sort of the study of consciousness and basic neuroscience, and also for therapeutic uses, for clinical applications, for, you know, a variety of different disorders, essentially to be used in healing for things like post-traumatic stress syndrome and this sort of thing. Now at the, you know, as the Hefter Institute has evolved, we're still doing work in basic neuroscience, but where the funding, you know, seems to be available more is when you've got a specific, you know, therapeutic application that you can present to people to, you know, treat something like post-traumatic stress syndrome or anxiety in cancer patients or this sort of thing. So we've really kind of emphasized a lot in our fundraising the use of psychedelics in a therapeutic manner.
MDMA studies for PTSD and things like that that have been going on through MAPS and that sort of thing. Similar.
Yeah.
And I know Dr. Charles Grobe was on the show back, 6 months ago, 5 months ago, and I believe he's a part of the Hefter Institute as well, isn't he?
Yes, he's also on the board. He's like me. He was there from the start. And, you know, we're similar to MAPS. It's just that we're a lot smaller than MAPS and sort of less political in some ways. I mean, MAPS is a much larger organization, and they've pretty much staked out the MDMA post-traumatic stress territory. But I admire what they're doing. Our goals are very similar to MAPS. It's just
Understood.
That we do it more quietly and with less money.
We do it better. I'm kidding.
Not necessarily better. But
I was kidding.
More.
But talk about plant medicines that you've helped develop.
Well, I don't know if I can really point to any specific plant medicines, maybe other than ayahuasca. I mean, you know, my chief contribution to this whole area has been in 1993 and 1990, actually starting in 1991, I helped organize a biomedical investigation of ayahuasca in South America. Charlie Grobe was also on that project. This was really pre-Hefter. This was about the time Hefter was forming.
Marlene DeRios and Michael Winkelman a part of that too, or was that before?
Well, that came later.
That
came much, much later. There was a follow-up study years later looking at the use of ayahuasca, or WASCA as the UDV call it, among adolescents, but our original study was conducted in 1993. Charlie Grobe, Jace Calloway, myself, Flaucus Brito, who was a Brazilian doctor, and it was really an international collaboration. And it was not looking for any therapeutic application. It was really an observational study, just data gathering, because nobody had ever really collected information on ayahuasca. But out of that came, I think we published about about six peer-reviewed papers that came out of that work. And really the chief sort of finding, I guess you could say, that pointed to a possible therapeutic use of ayahuasca was that in the subjects we looked at, these members of the UDV who had all been members for at least 10 years, some of them as long as 40 years, all of them more or less had been quite dysfunctional before they joined the UDV, and their primary problems were usually alcoholism or other forms of substance abuse or other forms of dysfunctional behavior. And they all pretty much changed their lives around after they joined the UDV and they had these experiences. Initially, we conducted psychiatric interviews with all of the subjects, and they described kind of their life story, you know, how they came to join the UDV and the influence it's been in their lives and so on. Excuse me. And they all pretty much told the same story that they, you know, their lives were out of control before they joined the church, and they joined the church. Their initial experiences were quite terrifying, and it usually kind of showed them where they were headed if they didn't get straightened out. And they got straightened out and they changed their behavior, and they credited not simply ayahuasca, not simply the tea that they drank, but also the context of being in the UDV. And they all said, you know, we couldn't do it without having been in the UDV, which is to be expected. I mean, any good church member is going to say that, right? And I'm right. quite certain that the community did supply a lot of support and encouragement for people that were trying to, you know, change their lives. What we also found that was interesting was that the tea appeared to elicit a long-term neurochemical effect, in that it modulated it raised the density of serotonin transporters in the brain. And this was not an acute effect. This was a long-term effect that actually made the members who had been drinking it regularly different from controls who did not drink it. And, you know, that was one of the sort of basic questions we wanted to ask when we got into this study, was the simple, naive question, you know, is there anything biochemically different about drinkers? Is there any biochemical marker of any kind that we can point to that says, yeah, you know, these people are different in some way? And we didn't really know what we were looking for. But when we found this difference, we were surprised to find that there was this difference in serotonin transporter density. And we didn't really know what it meant. But when we got into the literature, we found that there was actually quite a lot of literature on deficits in serotonin transporters. In other words, abnormally low levels of these serotonin transporters, and those were correlated with, guess what, alcoholism, or so-called type 2 alcoholism, which is alcoholism with a tendency to violence, certain kinds of depression, certain kinds of suicidal or homicidal behavior. In other words, certain kinds of dysfunctionalities that people have, and there was a remarkable similarity to a lot of the pathologies that the UDP members were describing to us, particularly the alcoholism, the tendency to violence, and this kind of thing. So we thought, aha, you know, here we have, on one hand, we've got the psychiatric data, you know, their own testimony that they changed their lives, and we've got this interesting biochemical correlation, this biochemical marker that, you know, looks like maybe they had these transporter deficits, and maybe drinking the ayahuasca over time has actually, reversed that deficit, has actually raised the level of these transporters. So, you know, it seemed like a very neat correlation. And there needs to be follow-up on it. You know, I mean, that would be the basis for doing a more controlled kind of clinical study of ayahuasca in the right population, you know, that you could screen ahead of time for these deficits and then follow them over time and see, you know, did the long-term changes in the brain correlate with the changes in behavior, or are there changes in behavior? Of course, there's problems with studying ayahuasca, you know, in that context. It problems with doing it in this country anyway. But that's probably, you know, in the whole realm of, I guess, ethnopharmacology or ayahuasca, I guess that's in some ways my best claim to fame, because I, you know, I did play a pretty significant role in organizing that study and finding the money for it and so on, even though I wasn't the principal investigator, I was the participant. But, you know, for a clinical study, you have to have a physician, you have to have an MD, and Charlie was willing to do it, and he's the perfect person for that. So I was there, but I was not running the study.
Understood.
So beyond that, well, you know, not too much in terms of developing products. I have worked for, as I say, various supplement companies on various projects. I've advised them on formulations and ingredients and that sort of thing. But I can't really point to any one thing, you know, and say, you know, this is Dr. McKenna's elixir of life or anything like that. You know, I have advised people. I advised Odwalla, for example, on some of their juice formulations. Maybe one of my contributions, not really in the area of psychedelics exactly, but I've been interested in kava for a number of years, and I helped get funding actually through the Hefter, kind of a sidetrack for us, but we were able to get the grant. I found funding and help participate in a study of kava, of the Hawaiian varieties of kava. So it really wasn't a therapeutic study at all. It was trying to get a handle on what is the chemical variation in the Hawaiian kavas. And that was interesting to the industry at the time. There was great hope that kava was going to become the next new natural anxiolytic. And then it got some bad press over the potential to cause liver damage. And it pretty much, the kava market pretty much fell apart. But in fact, it doesn't cause liver damage. This was junk science, basically. But you know, kava was a significant competitor with prescription anxiolytics, especially in Europe. So I have the feeling that there was probably some, you know, effort to discredit it because it was
pharmaceutical company scam. They don't do that stuff, do they? Uh-oh, I lost you again. Hello? Lost you again.
send the pharmaceutical cartel, you know, listening, you know.
Well, let's do this. You know, I really don't want to let you go before I get to what I really wanted to interview you about. Which was about plant intelligence and plant communication. Are you still good to do a little wrap about that before we wrap things up?
Well, sure. Yeah, I can do that. You know, the issue around plant intelligence really has to do with plant communication. And, you know, I mean, plants communicate with their environment through chemistry. This is the thing. Plants are photosynthetic. So they can make simple organic compounds from sunlight, water, and carbon dioxide, right? This is the trick that they have mastered that we have yet to master. And as a result of that, they make this sort of vast array of chemical compounds. This is one of the things that separates plants from everything else. Everything else in the biosphere is essentially a parasite on plants. We and everything that is not autotrophic, that doesn't make its own food, depends on these autotrophic photosynthetic organisms to sustain life on Earth. And that's how, you know, people don't, or maybe they do, but I think people overlook in some ways what a miracle photosynthesis is, because photosynthesis is the way that energy comes into the planetary ecosystem from outer space and is actually captured and runs the whole shooting match, runs the biosphere. Everything directly or indirectly depends on the plant kingdom. And plants, well, a famous botanist once said, plants have substituted biosynthesis for behavior, which I think is an interesting way to put it. In other words, animals react to their environment through behavior, the fight or flight reaction. For example, you know, you respond to a threat by either running away or defending yourself or whatever. Well, plants don't have the option to run away, you know, but they also have to interact with their environment. And so they do so through chemistry, essentially through biosynthesis. The same molecules that might interact with the nervous systems of primates, you know, like us, you know, the curious ape, whatever, might also serve the plant in a number of different ways. You know, at every level of organization, plants communicate with other organisms in their environment, including animals, including other plants, including, you know, insects. This is very well established in insects, the symbiotic relationships that exist between insects and plants are entirely mediated through chemistry. And so I think that is the basis of plant intelligence. You know, they have figured out in a way how to create this vast sort of diversity of messenger molecules. That's really what all these secondary compounds are. They're messenger molecules in some ways, either molecules that may have a very simple message, might be stay away, you know. So if it's toxic, it might be a repellent, or it might be a fragrance that would attract a pollinator, or a color of a fruit, which is still a pigment, essentially, to attract something, to consume the fruit and then disperse the seeds. Now, it gets more interesting when you're talking about, you know, these neurotransmitter-like molecules that plants make that are similar to the neurotransmitter molecules that, you know, mediate consciousness in, you know, our overdeveloped brains. But I think it's all part and parcel of that, you know, that we, you know, I mean, plant messages that might to any other animal might be a signal to stay away or avoid eating the plant because it's toxic might to a primate, you know, who is blessed for curiosity, might actually be a signal to be attracted to it, you know, because they like the feeling that it induces, right. You know, oh yeah, you can, maybe you can smoke this, you know? And so that type of mediation, that type of exchange that goes on between the plant, excuse me, I'm getting a little hoarse here, and a complex organism like us gets much more complicated, because then you get into aspects of symbiosis. And, you know, it's in the plant's interest to form a symbiosis with other species, especially with us. You know, the whole process of a plant domestication essentially is, you know, us, the primates, taking the plant under its wing and in some ways insulating it from having to compete out in the wild with everything else. So as long as, you know, we can keep that domestication going, it's good for us because the plant produces something that, you know, we value, whether it's a medicine or a nutrient or a pigment or a perfume or whatever we might be getting from it. And it's useful for the plant because, you know, you've got this species that's going to nurture it, propagate it, spread it all around. And that is really, you know, the sort of, that is the goal of the plant, is to, you know, be fruitful literally and multiply. And that's pretty much, you know, constitutes evolutionary success as far as the plant is concerned. So by forming these alliances that are chemically mediated, you know, the plant is very clever in some sense. I mean, that is plant intelligence. That's one form of plant intelligence. I mean, there are many other forms as well, but that's an idea. You know, did you talk about Stephen Buhner?
Yes, indeed. Stephen, yes. His work on, I had him on to discuss his work in sacred and herbal healing beers, which I think is a huge area in the field of ethnobotany that doesn't get much coverage. So
that's true.
Great.
But
great
are show. You familiar with his other book? I guess he's written more than one, but this book,
he's written, I think, 12 or 15 books, I think. But no, I'm not. I've only read that one of his.
Well, his book, the only one I'm familiar with really is The Lost Language of Plants, but I was very impressed by it. And in that book, he talks about this, about, you know, how the language of plants is a chemical language. This is how plants, you know, communicate with the environment and in some ways regulate the environment. It's through these complex webs of chemical communication that ecosystems are stabilized. And in his book, the reason it's the lost language, one of the things about his book, one of the main themes in his book, is how these webs of chemical equilibrium are becoming disrupted through pollution, especially pharmaceutical pollution. And the excretion of all of these pharmaceuticals into the environment is very dangerous in his view and also in mine, because it disrupts these homeostatic mechanisms that are keeping everything stable. And although the tonnage of pharmaceuticals that are excreted is small compared to the tonnage of other types of pollutants, but potentially much more dangerous, because pharmaceutical drugs are, you know, targeted at specific receptors, and they are designed in such a way by medicinal chemists, they're designed in such a way usually to work at extremely low concentrations, like micromolar or nanomolar or even subnanomolar concentrations. They're also usually designed to have long half-lives. So in other words, they're not easily broken down. Once they get into the environment, they persist. And, you know, what we're seeing going on with things like neuroendocrine, the endocrine disruptors and this kind of thing, you know, that's changing the sex ratios of frogs and this kind of thing. I mean, this is only the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more, things going on, and, you know, you can pick up pharmaceuticals in the groundwater of any major city. So the question is, what are the long-term effects of this, not only on us, you know, to be exposed to these low levels of these synthetic compounds that, you know, we haven't co-evolved with in the way that we've co-evolved with plant compounds, and in a larger sense, what are the environmental, ecological effects of these things, you know, being diffused into the environment? So, you know, I greatly admire his book, and I think he raises some issues that, you know, really we really need to be paying attention to.
What do you feel about Jeremy Narby's research in this area and his notions of DNA emitting light frequencies that possibly we pick up on?
Jeremy Narby, yeah. I mean, I think, again, you know, there is this intuition that people have, and I think there's a basis to it, that maybe in these shamanic states, you know, maybe you can actually look into cellular processes, you know, and maybe that is what is going on when you see double helix. I mean, you know, the shamans aren't the only one. You're probably familiar with Carrie Mullis's, recollections about his discoveries, and he attributes that to LSD. He's quite upfront about it. And
yeah, I used to know Carrie.
Oh yeah. Well, so he's the character, right?
Yeah, definitely.
But also a brilliant guy who made this discovery. And finally, after many years, even I think, was it Francis Crick finally came out of the closet and allowed us how, yes, a lot of his insights into the discovery of DNA was attributable to LSD. So, you know, I mean, Terence used to say, you know, one of the most interesting things about psychedelics is they make you have funny ideas, you know, and funny ideas are both dangerous and in some ways creative. I mean, you know, what is a funny idea at one time, you know, in one instance is, you know, a major breakthrough, a major discovery in another context. If people didn't have funny ideas, you know, nothing would go forward. This is how knowledge advances, I think. You know?
Right.
And so any agent that can facilitate funny ideas, so what? 98% of them are crap.
You know, it doesn't matter. But when you get one that lands you the Nobel Prize, like Carrie Mullis or Francis Crick, then it changes the world.
Right. In any field of intellectual inquiry, most of the ideas are crap. Most of them have no validity. But occasionally you stumble on a gem. And, you know, I think anything that can facilitate that is worth looking into. And that's another thing about the psychedelics. They give us tools, you know, to examine things like, you know, these concepts. They can be applied to problem solving issues. They give us tools to, you know, to experimentally in some ways approach things like mystical states of mind or transcendent states of mind, as you know, Roland Griffith's work at Johns Hopkins with psilocybin has pretty well demonstrated. You know, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with those studies. Are you? You studied?
Yeah, definitely. I've interviewed Roland Griffiths. He's a part of this project as well.
Okay. Well, I think that's a major, actually a very important study because, you know, one of the chief findings that came out of that study was, you know, for those people who were not psychedelic inclined but interested in, you know, religious matters and philosophical matters and so on, but, you know, 37% said it was the most significant experience of their lives. You know, well, my God, if we have a pharmaceutical that can elicit the most significant experience of your life, you know, I think we ought to be looking into that. I mean, because I think that is largely, in some ways, you know, our spiritual or cultural crisis is that life has become bereft of meaning for people. And, you know, I mean, the religions, the established religions are not delivering anymore. You know, they become hollowed out. They become as much as they become political bludgeons, basically, to, you know, browbeat people into and just accepting the way things are. And, you know, and here's a tool that could actually help people connect with, you know, a sense of a real mystery, real significance in their life. And, you know, that's worth looking into, I think. And, you know, and this is why, you know, psychedelics are very promising and at the same time, you know, very dangerous. I mean, dangerous not in the sense that it's dangerous to take them, but it's dangerous because they make you have funny ideas, and funny ideas are dangerous, particularly to the established power structures. You know, that's what it's really about. That's the danger.
Right, and I think there is a danger when people don't know of the potential dangers of facing their own psychological stuff that can cause bad experiences and things that unless they're
right.
aware of and have foreknowledge about, they can get themselves in bad spots and do stupid things like jump off a bridge that gets mushrooms banned in Holland, you know.
Right. Well, this is why, you know, as elders and people that have been into this for a long time, we need to, you know, we need to counsel common sense and sensible use, you know, and things that Leary and Metzner and people like that said from the first. It's all about set and setting, you know. This is why in indigenous cultures where these things are used, it's, you know, it's the shamanic setting, the shaman sets the stage for it to happen, creates a space for the experience to unfold that's basically safe, and that he or she can exert a certain amount of control in terms of how the experience is going to unfold. I mean, I think in counseling young people or advising young people who want to do this, I think this is the main thing, you know. Set and setting. You have to pay attention to set and setting. You know, what set being, of course, who you are and what you bring to it and what your expectations are and essentially everything that you bring to the experience. Setting being the circumstances under which you can do it. And some circumstances are, you know, not appropriate. I mean, the Hollywood freeway at rush hour is probably not when you want to be smoking DMT, you know, or taking salvia divinorum or some of these things. But, you know, so you have to pay attention to the circumstances. And I think that's where most people who are inexperienced get into trouble. They don't pay enough attention, and they don't have anyone there who's able to, you know, look after them if that's what they need.
So, what do you feel is the, you know, and I know you talked about it a little bit earlier. I think I've got some idiot outside my window here revving his motorcycle. But What do you feel is the most important area requiring further research?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I think that we should continue looking, you know, at the potential therapeutic uses of these psychedelics. I think that's very important. I think we've barely begun to explore that, you know, but at the same time, I don't think we should become preoccupied with that to the extent we should not overlook the fact that that's a small part of the total sphere of things that these things touch on. I think that as tools for exploring and understanding consciousness and exploring consciousness, which after all is all we have, right? I mean, everybody lives in their own 3-pound universe. Everyone lives in their own, you know, constructed reality, our own hallucination, if you will. And these psychedelics are important tools for kind of pushing that envelope, for actually tweaking the envelope to see what is possible, you know, in terms of conscious perception. So I think there is the whole realm of, you know, the kind of stuff you can do in the laboratory, you know, with these things, fMRI and even less, you know, sexy tools. I mean, fairly simple tools that you can learn a lot. If you look at the work of Franz Wohlenfeiter, you can learn a lot about basic processes that govern consciousness by using psychedelics in conjunction with some pretty simple types of perceptual tests. So I really think that their value as medicines is important for therapeutic uses. I think their value is even more important as tools in basic neuroscience to try to understand this, you know, what is quickly emerging, I think, as probably the major scientific mystery of the 21st century, which is consciousness, the mind-body relationship, the relationship between consciousness and the brain. I mean, this is the cutting edge of human understanding. And I think that, you know, any model of human consciousness that does not take into account the kinds of phenomena, the kinds of experiences that can be elicited by psychedelics is incomplete by definition. You know, psychedelics can do these things that no other thing can do. If you want to have a comprehensive model of mind, you have to account for this. And so, you know, you've got to come to grips with that. So that's where I think the real frontier is, because, you know, in the future, I mean, and we are already in the future, you know, but in the next 10 to 15 years, you know, but as a species, you know, we're going to be trying to, you know, we need to have an understanding of consciousness. We're going to be building machines that essentially are conscious, you know, and things like this, you know, I mean, true artificial intelligence, this kind of thing, it's going to impact our lives greatly, and it's very important that we understand a lot more about consciousness than we understand now. Both in order to be able to build these things, if that's what we decide we want to do, and also cope with that once that does come online.
What's the most important thing that you would like people to remember about this interview?
Oh, I don't know. that's difficult to say. I mean, I guess, I don't know. Not a fair question. Yeah. I mean, I just hope that they, if they come away with anything, I hope it's been stimulating for them. Mostly, if they come away with any one take-home lesson, it is the notion, it is to remember that, you know, we don't know very much. And, you know, we don't know much. And yet what we do know is pretty amazing. So, you know, don't forget to be astonished. I guess that's probably the take-home lesson. You know, the world's a marvelous place. We don't know very much about it at all, which means that, you know, the challenge for us is to learn as much as we can and, you know, to, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get into cliches, but I think that wonder and the ability to be astonished is a very valuable human trait. And if we are able to hang on to that, we won't be bored and we might learn something. So I guess that's it.
All right. And would you like to give the name of your books or other projects, websites, contact information, anything you would care to let people know and give out as we wrap this
well,
up?
Well, sure. Well, yeah, the books people know about. I haven't really set up a website yet. I can, well, those that want to contact me can do so by email. My email address is djmckenna@mac.com, all lowercase, all one word. Please don't all 42,000 people write me immediately. That's all I ask. But that's where I can be reached.
All right, and this is the end of Gnostic Media Podcast number 26. You've been listening to Dr. Dennis McKenna. Dennis, thank you so much for being on the show, and I really appreciate your time and dedication and putting up with all of the phone disconnects and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, Jan. It's been a pleasure.